provide?
For us, the evaluation and the assessment is important. So in one way, we are providing some services, and the other way around, we need to see the impact, the consequences, and so on. So in emergency activities, for example, I can refer to 2010 or 11 famine issue in Somalia, or then we had the project of the hunger resilience in Somalia and Kenya for the Somalian refugees and then displaced population who were in Kenya and the surrounding country. I could say, and I can confess, that it was really one of the largest operations we had in Africa, because in 2010 and 11 we had more than 22 different campsites in Somalia, which, I mean, the country was divided into different, let's say, parts, but as a humanitarian neutral organization, so we were both in Mogadishu, we were in Somaliland, we were in Hargeisa, so no matter where the people are living, for us it was only the consent of the different partners, I can say, the government, and also the requirements which were on the ground. So we were there, we provide our and offer our humanitarian assistance to the people.
Now, you earlier talked about the issue of the COVID-19 pandemic and the services you're providing in Africa. Can you elaborate? Because we are still in the pandemic right now.
Yeah, exactly. But when in 2020, the pandemic has started. Fortunately, Africa was one of those continent or place of the world which had less impact of the of the COVID. But at the same time, we were curious to assist those people who are in need, and because the situation, especially the medical and health situation in different countries, were not let's say suitable or appropriate, so we try to assist those people. So we have our medical centers in different countries. Through our medical centers, or directly we could also assist, for example, in different countries like Sierra Leone or DRC. We have deployed also the hygiene items, the medical items from Iran to those countries.
Very good.
And even for the vaccination part, we also made our readiness to provide vaccines to different African countries. Still, we are in contact with some of them.
Now, you have mentioned a very important point there, that you are taking Iranian health or medical products to Africa. Now, apart from the COVID-19 pandemic, I believe you are also taking other medical products and medicine to Africa. So how are the people responding to these products which are actually made in Iran, both medicine and medical products?
I tell you interesting story. I was in West Africa, so we have clinics in Ivory Coast, Ghana, Sierra Leone, and those countries. And we also send and submit the medicines, Iranian medicines, to those countries. So I have witnessed myself, and people, when they refer to the medical center and they came to the pharmacy, they only request for the Iranian medicine.
Oh,
I asked one of the patients, she was a very, let's say, old lady, but at the same time, she was a very nice, gentle lady. Yeah. I asked her, so there are lots of medicines in the country from different countries. Yeah. Why are you preferring the Iranian one?
Iranian medicine.
And she said to me directly, saying that, because we do believe that Iranian medicine is not medicine. So the impact and the treatment we receive from the Iranian medicines is part of our belief. And we do believe that both Iranian medical doctors, personnel, and medicines can have more impact on the health of the issue. And then we can get better and recover much more easier. So I think it is because of two issues if we want to evaluate the situation. The first one is the quality of the Iranian production of medicines, and the second one is the belief itself. So people, they think, and it has this, I can say, the psychological also impact on their mind. So if they use this sort of medicine,
they
will be better, and the care would be much more better to their health, let's say, issues. So for this one, I think Iranian medicines have very good, let's say, room in different parts of Africa.
Yeah. And right now, several UN agencies have warned that some African regions like the Sahel and the Horn of Africa, I mean Somalia, Ethiopia, and parts of northern Kenya, will be facing a severe food crisis. which is, of course, a global problem, but the impact will be more severe in these parts of Africa. Now, does the Iranian Red Crescent Society have any plans to provide humanitarian assistance to these regions during this period?
The Hunger Resilience Project, which we had trilaterally with the Kenyan Red Cross, the Somalian Red Crescent, and International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent in Horn of Africa, was a very, very successful project we had, because we could, let's say, cover lots of Somalian land, as well as those refugees who were in Kenya, and provide them the food security assistance. So it is nowadays, because of the development we have in different parts of the world, access to food is an issue, a serious challenge.
Yeah.
So we are in very close contact with our Red Cross and Red Crescent partners in different countries, as you mentioned, in Ethiopia, in Central Africa, or the other countries. So if they request, and either bilaterally or through the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, we can have this sort of the project in Africa, and we would be very pleased to have this kind of the collaboration with our national sister societies in African countries.
Now, and just as a follow-up to your answer there, you've talked about your collaboration with your counterpart societies, Red Crescent or Red Cross societies in Africa. What exchange programs now do you have with these societies apart from hunger resilience issues?
So we normally have a sort of the memorandum of understanding or an agreement with our sister national societies, and in the memorandum we will agree what kind of the activities we can have. So among them, I can say the training is really important. Let's say capacity building of the national society and the people is important. We also try to provide direct assistance, whether it is the food security, water, health and sanitation, as well as the health issues. So this kind of the collaboration, normally we agree, and then based on this collaboration, we have an agreement. We define the projects, and based on those projects, we can provide the humanitarian assistance to the people.
Now, we are almost running out of time, but I'd just like you to tell us briefly, what are your plans for expansion in Africa?
Yeah, that's a good question. Expansion of the activities in Africa, first, it is the requirements, of course, that are there, and then the consent of the national societies and the government. So we need to agree. For example, in Ghana, now they think that after being almost 30 years, we need to expand the medical center as a big hospital. So now it is under the discussion, negotiation. How can we... we can have just recently, this week, we had a very, high-ranking officials from Ghana. They came to Iran. Two ministers were among them, and we had some sort of the bilateral discussion also to expand the activities. So in different parts of the Africa, no matter where Iran Red Crescent is there or not, but we are ready to assist more if it is necessary.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hassan Isfandiari. He's the Director General for International Operations and Humanitarian Programs at the Iranian Red Crescent Society. We appreciate his presence here. And that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Send us your comments through our social media handle, and also let us know the topics you would like to see covered here in our program. Goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight. The UK's Institute for Fiscal Studies believes the rise in domestic energy prices alone pushed the inflation rate for the poorest tenth of households to as high as 14%, compared with 8% for the richest households. We now present you an article written by Philip Inman. The piece is titled, As Food and Fuel Costs Rise, There Is No Doubt the UK's Poorest Are Hardest Hit. Inflation is going to be with Britons for a few years yet. That's the growing consensus in the City of London and among economists who believe the impact of rising fuel prices, the crippling cost of imported goods, and labour shortages in many industries will have a longer legacy than first thought. Recently, all eyes were on rising gas prices and Ofgem's estimate that the energy price cap will rise by about £800 in October, to an average of £2,800 per household. The Office of Gas and Electricity Markets, Ofgem, supporting the Gas and Electricity Markets Authority, is the government regulator for the electricity and downstream natural gas markets in Britain. The regulator's gloomy outlook fueled fears that an even higher figure is coming down the track when the cap is revised in early 2023. Such is the momentum propelling gas and electricity prices higher. Recently, the focus is on food and how much British food production and the cost of imported produce is pushing up prices in the shops. Some inflation watchers have argued that rationing is partly to blame. Jack Monroe, the food writer and anti-poverty campaigner, argues cheaper, everyday groceries are disappearing from the shelves, leaving hard-pressed families no choice but to buy higher-priced alternatives. Jack Monroe said it meant that inflation for the poorest 20% of people is higher than for everyone else. She is not alone in her assessment. However, on Monday, 30th of May, she came up against the UK Office for National Statistics, which claimed it found plenty of low-priced goods in the shops and, according to its own surveys, price rises affecting these goods were no higher than for food generally. Disentangling Monroe's food inflation monitor from the basket of pasta, potatoes and sausages used by the Office of National Statistics is difficult. What cannot be contested, though, is that the poorest Britons are losing out, whether they are young families or pensioners living solely on the state's basic retirement income. The Institute for Fiscal Studies believes the rise in domestic energy prices alone pushed the inflation rate for the poorest tenth of households to as high as 14%, compared with 8% for the richest households. According to the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization Food Price Index, prices have climbed by about 20% so far this year. And a huge price shock in the fertilizer market means there is a risk of higher food costs will persist, especially when Russia and Belarus, two historically important sources of fertilizer for the global economy, are subject to sanctions. Another factor keeping factory-made good prices high is China imposing lockdowns on manufacturing centres and ports amid outbreaks of COVID-19. In Britain, Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak claimed his £15 billion package of energy support announced recently would not be inflationary, and there was some justification for the statement. Most of the money was targeted at lower-income families, with £650 each for the 8 million British households in receipt of benefits. And they're expected to spend it on escalating energy bills rather than fueling a renewed splurge in demand for goods and services. But the parallel £400 subsidy for all bill payers due in October, regardless of income, could be spent on goods from China or the many and varied services afflicted by labour shortages in Britain, where extra demand is only going to push prices upwards. Policymakers at the Bank of England, fearing that inflation has more legs, could add some extra interest rate rises to their current projection of another half a percentage point this year. This would lift Threadneedle Street's key base rate above 1.5% by the end of 2022. Higher interest rates are another form of inflation, just like Sunak's national insurance increase and freeze on income tax thresholds. They put pressure on employers to increase wages further, adding to costs that feed back into everyday prices, hitting the poor hardest. It would be calamitous if 500,000 businesses disappeared under a wave of inflationary costs, as predicted by the Federation of Small Businesses, FSB. No government would survive such a dramatic collapse in the business community. For this reason, it is likely to be dismissed inside the Treasury as an exaggerated and inflammatory estimate. However, officials would be foolish to dismiss the essence of the argument. For one thing, many businesses feel they have come to be seen inside government, and in No. 10 Downing Street in particular, as a bottomless well of cash to support the government's policy agenda. Minimum wage increases are imposed every year in excess of general wage rises to supposedly boost the incomes of the lowest paid. Promises that business rates will be reformed are delayed every year without fail, leaving high street stores to pay relatively high rates compared with Amazon warehouses. Employers' national insurance contributions has jumped to more than 15%. Corporation tax will increase from 19% to 25% from next year. All it will take is for the energy costs hitting households to wallop businesses, and the Federation of Small Businesses FSB prediction will be disturbingly accurate. Many businesses currently have fixed energy deals in place. These will run out later this year or in 2023. Then there will be trouble.
A museum to wonder and reflect, a prison for torture and control, and a spectacular palace fit for a king. Perhaps one might think that these three places don't have the faintest connection with each other. But it's amazing to see that the thread of time has woven them together to create the tapestry of the Qasr edifice. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. In this week's documentary, we take you to Tehran to explore a dreadful metamorphosis through time, the history of a palace that turned into a prison. But the story does not end there. The Qasr edifice has witnessed 200 years of Iran's history, the demise of the monarch era, and the birth of a revolution. Now, after more than three decades since the Islamic Revolution in Iran, we bring you the untold stories of those who experienced the horrors of the edifice in its darkest years. Stay with us. Here's the first part.
Ah! 1979, Tehran. The country is on the edge of a precipice. Street clashes are raging between the army and the people. Endless strikes are crippling the country. Prime ministers are being ousted one after another, and foreign nationals leaving the country. The Shah is helpless. The Shah is hopeless. Nothing can assuage the anger of the nation. A revolution is in sight. October the 24th, 1978. Tehran, the gas prison. A few months before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, a great number of political prisoners are released after years of being in prison and under torture. Since the beginning of the Pahlavi dynasty, the gas prison had been the graveyard of many political opponents. But within a few months, it would fall into the hands of revolutionaries, and a new chapter in the history of this edifice would begin. The name of this prison still conjures up images of many contemporary Iranian figures that fought heart and soul against the Pahlavi regime. The Ghas prison. Over the last two centuries, the building has undergone many fundamental changes, each one mirroring part of this land's history. Tehran, the Qasr Garden Museum. In 2001, the Qasr prison was closed down after 76 years. In a 10-year project, the municipality of Tehran converted it into the Qasr Garden Museum. The museum has three main parts: the Markov prison, the political prison, and a large garden the prisons are located in. In the Garden Museum, exhibition stands have been set up, each one representing a critical moment in the history of Iran. A number of political prisoners during the Pahlavi era are here to recount their first-hand experiences for visitors. The building is located in the center of Tehran, but around 200 years ago, during the Qajar dynasty, it was miles away from the city, in a district known as Khurram Abad Hills. In 1798, Fath Ali Shah, the second king of the Qajar dynasty, ordered a recreational palace to be built outside Tehran, a great palace that cost the court dearly.
Tehran, which we are today with this vast and glorious history,
during the early years of the Qajar dynasty, Tehran, which was the capital city of the country, was about 6 kilometers away from where the Qasr Garden Museum is now located in. In that era, this place was a green region with nice weather, to an extent that at the time it was known as Khurram Abad, or a verdant place.
Iranian palaces share a similar structure. A large garden with small brooks running through, a stately summer house in the middle, and a luxurious mansion at the end with numerous rooms for the Shah and his wives. It is said the palace cost the Shah 400,000 tomans, a huge sum of money in those days. Many foreigners visited the palace, among them Samuel G.W. Benjamin, the U.S. ambassador to Tehran, Pierre Amédée Joubert, Napoleon Bonaparte's envoy to the court of Fath Ali Shah, and Madame Carla Serena. Visiting the palace, Madame Serena was impressed by the paintings she saw there. Writing in her travel log, "The palace has been heavenly decorated, and the paintings done in the most delicate fashion." In 1806, His Majesty spent 3 months of March, April, and May at this palace. But the glory days didn't last long. During the reign of Nasruddin Shah, the palace fell from grace and, abandoned, a devastating flood razed it to the ground. After that, its precincts were used as military camps and makeshift war prisons. But the future had something else in store. When Reza Shah came to the throne, the country's penal system needed a complete overhaul. The number of prisoners was growing and the old prisons no longer met international standards. The government had to establish modern prisons and recognize civil rights for its convicts.
During the Qajar dynasty, prison was not basically like the one in the Pahlavi era. It was a small building made up of three rooms and some rooms in the basement. This was the police's detention center during the Qajar dynasty. But with the growing confrontation between the Iranian nation and the Pahlavi regime, the number of prisoners increased and the regime was prompted to establish a big prison. The Qajari prisons were old and small, more like dungeons than modern prisons, and couldn't accommodate the increasing number of prisoners. Brigadier Mohammad Dargahi, the Tehran chief of police, requested a new and larger prison. In 1927, Reza Shah commissioned Nikolai Markov, an Iranian architect of Georgian descent, to build the prison. Working for the municipality of Tehran, he had designed many buildings, including Tehran's post office and telecommunications and Alborz High School. Markov decided to build the prison in the south part of the dilapidated palace. The prison took 2 years to complete. In December 1929, it was opened with 192 rooms, designed to house 800 prisoners. In the opening ceremony, Brigadier Dargahi was showing the new prison to Reza Shah and other high-ranking officials. When the group reached the iron cell, the brigadier opened the door for the Shah and asked him and his entourage to step in. But the Shah refused to enter when he was warned by his court minister of a possible coup d'etat. 2 days later, Brigadier Dargahi was relieved of his command and became the first prisoner of this macabre prison. Under Reza Shah, the Ghass prison was the only prison in Tehran. In those days, prisoners were kept together without any classification. Many scholars, writers, and poets spent years of their lives within its walls. In the past, there were two underground canals that supplied drinking and irrigation water to the palace. Years later, when the palace was converted into the prison, the two canals had gushed out to the surface, and prisoners would quench their thirst from the freezing water. Hence the Persian idiom, to drink cool water, was coined. An idiom with a pleasant literal meaning, but an unpleasant reference. Shot in 1958, the footage shows prisoners busy with various activities. The edifice has seen many hard days when Iran, under the boots of Russian and English troops during World War II, was occupied and ruined, accused of being a nest for German spies. They destroyed the country's army, toppled Reza Shah from the throne, forcing him to exile, and made his son Mohammad Reza the king of Iran. The occupying forces took all national resources into their hands, letting thousands of Iranians starve to death.
year 1953 as a year indelibly imprinted on the mind of the edifice. That year, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, the Prime Minister at the time, nationalized the oil industry, a success that enraged the United Kingdom and the United States of America. On the 19th of August 1953, in an Anglo-American coup, the Prime Minister was removed from power and many Iranian nationalists arrested. The edifice bore witness to the demise of a nation's hope. Mohammad Reza Shah, who had fled the country, returned a few days after the coup.
اگر اون نهضت به شکست منجر نمی‌شد، عملاً ملت ایران در
It's quite natural that hadn't that movement failed, the Iranian nation would have continued its journey toward its historical perfection in a natural fashion and experienced its local balanced development. But the meddling in the national movement by imperial powers, that is the US and the UK, interrupted the current of balance, intrinsic development in Iranian society.
و درون زای جامعه ایران با اخلال روبرو بشه.
After the 1953 coup d'etat, the nation's pent-up anger came to the surface every now and then, while the regime searched desperately for ways to curb the situation. In the mid-1950s, a new organization was established with the help of the CIA and the Mossad. SAVAK, or the Organization of Intelligence and National Security, aimed to counteract any security threat to the country. Dr. Javad Mansouri was a political prisoner before the 1979 revolution in different prisons across the country.
بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332
After the 1953 coup d'etat, they decided to have a powerful organization to suppress the Iranian anti-imperialist movement, especially since the movement had continued for a long time and the regime was impotent. So in 1956, the bill was officially put forward and approved in Parliament, and with a design by the CIA, this organization was established. The CIA had even an office in Savak, and all plans, information exchanges, training, equipment were from the CIA.
کل برنامه‌ها، مبادله اطلاعات، آموزش، تجهیزات با CIA بود.
Nipping any protest in the bud, Savak planned to round up all political dissidents in the country. A need for more prisons was urgent now. New prisons were built around the Markov prison. One of them was for political prisoners, where a large number of political opponents of different trends spent years of their lives.
دقیقاً بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332 است که
Right after the 1953 coup d'etat, again due to the increase in the number of political prisoners and their inherent difference from criminals, in the early 1950s, a separate building was officially built as the political prison.
Of those prisoners, some work as docents at the Garden Museum, telling visitors their stories of the hardship they experienced there. Mr. Hossein Khan Ali is one of them. As a political dissident during the 1960s, he spent 5 years in the Shah's prisons.
There was a man in this prison for 30 years, Safar Khan Qahramanian. This man was for a long time in this room. For 16 years since he was arrested, no one was allowed to visit him. After 16 years, he was called up to the meeting room. He couldn't believe it. He was called a few times and he finally went to the meeting room. When he went there, he saw a woman with a little child and a man with her. The woman called him over. As he stood in front of her in the meeting room, she said, "Father, I'm your daughter." This is my child and this is my husband. Of all his family, only that girl had been left for him. All others had passed away. And that girl came here every week for the last remaining 14 years to visit her father.
After the events of June 1963, led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, SAVAK, an intelligence agency, turned into a secret police to crush any signs of revolt. And the Iron Fist became the signature of this fearsome organization. Habeas corpus was no longer a right for all people, and forced confessions and long detentions became SAVAK's repeat prescription for any political dissident.
In 1963, after the demonstrations of June the 5th and 6th, it was decided that suppressing the opponents had to be more vigorous and more extensive, and the opponents had to be treated more violently. It was here that the Mossad came to help SAVAK, and the Mossad also established an office in SAVAK and began to train, equip, and exchange information with SAVAK.
The 1953 coup ushered in the emergence of leftist parties. Though they couldn't play an important role in the political arena of a religious country like Iran, while the religious movement led by Ayatollah Khomeini aimed to raise public awareness, the leftist groups took arms to fight against the regime. Mr. Davood As-Sadi Khamenei was a founding member of the Islamic Society of Students in Stockholm. In 1977, soon after his return to Iran, As-Sadi was arrested for political activities inside the country. After a six-month interrogation, he was transferred to the Qasr prison. For him, there were two main ideologies in the prison.
In those days, there were two points of view for the struggle. Some held that the struggle must be a cultural struggle. From a cultural perspective, the society must reach a level so as not to accept a person as Shah. But there were some people that believed in the armed struggle. They aimed to announce their stance by killing the people near the Shah. And among those two groups, there were some people that believed in a combination of a cultural and an armed struggle. Anyway, this issue that the movement must be purely cultural was one of the views at the time which was preferred by many figures, that is, those who were intellectual.
اهل مطالعه بودن، اهل علم بودن، اهل دانش بودن، بیشتر این جنبه رو قبول داشتن.
In 1972, as the armed struggle against the Pahlavi regime gathered momentum, the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee was founded, aiming to establish close liaison between different security agencies and armed forces to confront the opponents. At the same time, a new prison was given to the committee. Many prisoners were killed in this prison under the brutal torture of SAVAK agents. Dr. Mansouri was in prison both before and after 1971. During his second imprisonment in the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee prison, he suffered harsh interrogation and harrowing tortures.
As سال 50 رژیم شاه برخوردش با زندانیان سیاسی بسیار خشن خصمانه.
From the year 1971, the Pahlavi regime treated political prisoners very brutally and revengefully. Before that, they would treat a political prisoner like a bankrupt in a very ordinary way. But from 1971 on, they were facing people they considered as their sworn enemies who intended to overthrow the regime. The treatment was so brutal that they thought no one would dare go this way, or that prisoners would never resume their activities after being released.
بتونه تو این مسیر را بیاد. اگر یه زندانی هم آزاد شد دیگه از حواس زندان نکنه مثلا.
After the year 1971, the regime had initiated a shake-up in the way they treated political dissidents. Almost all of those arrested for political reasons underwent long, excruciating interrogations.
یک روز عصری، حالا گویا بازجوها بیکار بودند، حوصله‌شون سر رفته بود.
One afternoon, it seemed that the interrogators had nothing to do and were bored. They called me and another young man who had come from abroad, and I didn't know him. They put us in front of each other, forcing us to beat each other, but we didn't. They told him to beat me. He refused, and therefore they gave him a beating. Then they left him alone and told me to beat him. I also refused, and then they gave me a beating.
دیگه در حد بیحال شدن منو زدن.
He beat me very hard. Then another interrogator arrived and said, I know this guy. He is not an important person. Take him to the cell and release him tomorrow. They grabbed my arms and dragged me back into the cell. 1 week passed by, but no one came to release me.
هیچ کس سراغم نیامد. بعد از یک هفته اسمم رو صدا کردم.
After 1 week, they called me and took me directly to the torture room. Usually they would take us to the interrogation room and then to the torture room. They took me directly to the torture room. They aimed to break one's concentration so that one couldn't speak about anything in a measured way.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on May 7th, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of the International Al-Quds Day. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, in his speech on the occasion of International Quds Day, referring to the change in the balance of power in favor of Islamic world and Palestine, emphasized, I tell you with confidence the downward movement of the Zionist regime has started and will not stop.
Holy Quds and the entire Palestine belongs to those people, the Palestinians, and they will regain its possession again. Nor is that for Allah any great matter. The Holy Quran, chapter 14, verse 20. All Muslim governments and nations are responsible towards Palestine, but the Palestinians themselves are the pivot of the jihad, and their population reaches about 14 million people inside and outside the land. The unity and the unanimous willpower of those people will work wonders. The enemies of Palestinian unity are the Zionist regime, the US and some other political powers. But if unity is not shattered from inside the Palestinian society itself, the extrinsic enemies will not be able to do anything.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine. Tomorrow we'll be free. Palestine. Tomorrow we'll be free.
The pivot of this unity should be national jihad and lack of trust in the enemies. The main enemies of the Palestinians, the US, England, and vicious Zionists, should not be used as a source of support for Palestinian politics. All Palestinians, including the Palestinians in Gaza, in Quds, in the West Bank, in 1948 lands, and even the ones living in refugee camps, form a single unit, and they should adopt the strategy of coalitions. Every part should defend another part, and when under pressure, they should utilize the tools at their disposal.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his allies have launched an emergency effort to lobby wavering MPs as Johnson faces the spiralling threat of a confidence vote in his leadership that could put his position under threat within days. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalists Jessica Elgarth, Peter Walker and Aubrey Allegretti. The piece is titled Boris Johnson's Allies Lobby MPs to Stop Tory Support Draining Away. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his allies have launched an emergency effort to lobby wavering MPs as Johnson faces the spiralling threat of a vote of confidence in his leadership that could put his position under threat within days. By Tuesday night, 31st of May, at least 44 Conservative MPs had publicly questioned Boris Johnson's fitness to hold office, including 18 who are known to have sent letters to Sir Graham Brady, chair of the 1922 Committee of Conservative Backbenchers, to formally seek a confidence vote. The remainder have openly called for the Prime Minister to resign or said they had lost faith in his leadership. The growing rank of public critics was joined on Tuesday by Andrea Leadsom, the former cabinet minister, saying there had been a failure of leadership inside No. 10 Downing Street. Two further MPs, both of whom hold government posts and so have not spoken publicly, are also known to have submitted letters. Separately, The Guardian has seen letters to constituents or public statements from at least 35 further MPs that suggest they are openly questioning the Prime Minister's future or express deep disquiet at events in No. 10, including former ministers Richard Graham and Mark Garnier, and the 2019 MP Anthony Brown. Anthony Brown, who told constituents he had lost his mother during the pandemic, said he was dismayed by the behaviour shown by the Prime Minister and senior staff at No. 10 Downing Street, and concurred that there was a poor culture and a failure of senior leadership, both political and official. It is right they must bear responsibility, he said. Former Minister Mark Garnier said that some would question the probity of the Metropolitan Police and how their view on what happened seems to differ from what appears in released photographs, but suggested he would wait for an inquiry by the Commons Privileges Committee to report back on whether Boris Johnson had misled MPs. Former Minister Richard Graham told constituents he would not be issuing a new statement until the privileges report was over, and would not reveal whether he would send a letter. But he said other colleagues had decided the Prime Minister had misled Parliament and should resign, and I respect their views. Under Conservative rules, if 15% of the parliamentary party, amounting to 54 MPs, sent letters to Sir Graham Brady, then this triggers a vote of confidence. Boris Johnson would then need to win the backing of at least 180 MPs, half of the parliamentary party plus one, to remain in office. Sir Graham Brady, the chair of the 1922 Committee of Conservative Backbenchers, declined to comment on Tuesday, 31st of May, about whether it was close to the threshold. You can always ask, he told BBC. I say to people they are very free to do that, and I shall retain my discretion. I can say nothing more. There is, nonetheless, increasing expectation that enough letters have arrived or will soon be sent for a confidence vote next week, or otherwise this could happen should the Conservatives perform badly in two key by-elections next month. While it is possible that Sir Graham Brady could announce a confidence vote during the current parliamentary recess, senior Conservative sources have suggested Brady would hold off until the Queen's Platinum Jubilee at the weekend. As the sense of crisis deepened inside No. 10 Downing Street, Conservative whips began phoning MPs to try to secure their support. Reports said Boris Johnson had also done this, hinting at possible promotion, although one Downing Street source claimed he was too busy. Letsom, who served as business secretary under Boris Johnson, published a letter to constituents saying last week's report into lockdown-breaching parties inside Downing Street showed significant failures of leadership, both political and official. Each of my Conservative MP colleagues and I must now decide individually on what is right course of action that will restore confidence in our government, she argued. Also on Tuesday, John Stevenson, the MP for Carlisle, said he had added his name to those writing to Sir Graham Brady. He said, sadly, the Prime Minister appears to be unwilling to bring matters to a head and submit himself to a vote. Therefore, the only option is for Conservative MPs to facilitate a vote of confidence. I have already taken the appropriate action. Opponents have already begun seeking to convince enough MPs to vote against Johnson if a confidence vote does happen, arguing that if the Prime Minister secured a narrow win, he would either limp towards election defeat or risk a snap poll. We need to get to 160 or he'll destroy all our electoral hopes, one said. Amid the fallout from last week's Sue Gray's report into No. 10 parties, Boris Johnson wrote to his independent adviser on the Ministerial Code of Conduct, Lord Gate, to say that as the arbiter of the code, he did not believe he had breached it by being fined for attending his birthday party. In relation to the fixed penalty notice for my attendance in the Cabinet Room on 19th of June 2020, I believe that, taking account of all the circumstances, I did not breach the code of conduct, Johnson wrote, adding that the Chancellor Rishi Sunak who was fined for the same event, was also in the clear.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Members of the Academic Forum of the Islamic Movement in Nigeria have visited Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki on the occasion of the anniversary of the passing away of the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. They described Imam Khomeini as a true leader who fought against oppression and injustice, not just in Iran, but everywhere around the world. Sheikh Zazaki described Imam Khomeini as an exemplary and upright leader who has become a role model for youths everywhere.
The academic forum consists of youths now. Now the youths who fought the revolution in the 70s are now old people. Now the ball is in the court of the youths up to today, particularly in Nigeria, where we find ourselves in a situation of chaos.
Sheikh Zazaki said Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution was an inspiration to many people around the world who want to establish truth and social justice.